for still being here at 6:15 on a Friday. You always know when you're giving the crackpot talk when they put you at the end of the day on Friday. So, what I'm going to talk about, hopefully I won't take too much of your time, is an issue to do with non-Gaussianity that's often neglected. And this is very much work in progress with Rich Holman, so please feel free to ask questions during this. It's going to be quite informal. So I'm going to be thinking purely in the context of inflation, sort of standard slow roll inflation. Now, non-Gaussianity in general, it measures two things. One thing is it measures is the interactions of the inputon. And so in particular, depending on where those interactions occur, you'll get different shape dependence. If those interactions occur at horizon crossing, then you get these equilateral triangles within the three-point function. If the interactions occur at superhopple scales, then you'll typically get the local squeeze contribution. But non-Gaussianity also measures something else. It measures the extent to which the initial state of the inflaton at the beginning of inflation was non-Gaussian. So I could always imagine that instead of starting out the inflation with a Bunch-Davis vacuum state, I just give the inflaton some, I imagine I'm in some excited state. So for example, I could describe that by some wave function. So the Bunch-Davis vacuum can be thought of as a Schrodinger wave function that looks a bit like that. But I could always add some cubic term in that wave function, for example. And that would correspond to starting out in an initial state in which the three-point function for the inflaton, so here zeta, I'm always going to work with zeta, which is in spatially flat gauge, just equal to h delta phi over phi dot. So for slow roll case, that's basically delta phi root epsilon. And back. So the question I want to address is simply to what extent, if inflation started out in some excited state, to what extent would you expect to see that at late times? Now the first thing you say whenever you say this is the first thing to think, well, surely if inflation occurs for a very large number of e-folds, this is going to wipe out all information on the initial state. And that statement is pretty much true. But the question is, how many e-folds does it take to do it? And so very naively, you might think, oh, well, 60 e-folds is going to suppress any of this answer by a factor of e to the minus 60, and it's going to make it negligible. And the surprising thing, well, I hope to convince you, that is not actually the answer. So before I get to sort of estimating how large effects you would expect to see, just a few comments about, you know, when we do inflationary calculations, we always take this Bunch-Davis vacuum state. Why do we do that? And it's really not that, you know, we imagine that we start out inflation in exactly this state, but it's precisely this fact that if the number of e-folds is large, then we expect that whatever state we see at late times to look very close to the Bunch-Davis vacuum state. And now, to understand why that is true, the crucial step in that assumption is that, so the Schrodinger equation is a linear equation. So I could have just initially given any wave function with any large degree of non-Gaussianity. But the point is that as soon as you excite a state, that state will have some non-zero stress energy. So you'll have some T mu nu in whatever, in this excited state. And the crucial point is that this stress energy better never be bigger than the energy density of the inflaton itself, which goes like h squared m Planck squared. Otherwise, inflation wouldn't be occurring. So it would contradict the assumption that you're making that inflation is occurring. And it's this is the key assumption that is why to a good approximation, using the Bunch-Davis vacuum is correct. Because for the number of e-folds we usually consider for inflation to have horizon problem, this condition constrains the state so that after sort of 60 e-folds, You don't see the departures from, it's very difficult to see departures from the Bench-Davis vacuum from the initial state. But okay, that's the simple story. What I'm hoping to try and convince you though is if inflation is not too long, so I'm gonna, for the purposes of this talk, for me inflation is short if the number of E folds is less than 70, which is about, so 70 E folds is about the number of E folds such that the, if you look at the CMB scales today, look at the beginning of inflation, so the mass scale of those modes at the beginning of inflation would have been order M Planck. So for the purposes of this talk, I'm always going to imagine that our inflationary models have a short number of E folds, short, where short is relative to 70, so somewhere between sort of 55 and 70, enough to solve the horizon problem, but not too much that we get into the trans-Planckian region. And that's because I want to avoid questions about trans-Planckian physics, as I don't know how to describe those. Okay, so now a couple of comments. That what I'm going to say, so the way people often phrase the situation with taking some initial state different than the Bench-Davis vacuum is they think of it, you're choosing a different vacuum state. But really, I prefer to think that the Bench-Davis is the correct vacuum, and every other state is just an excited state relative to that. And that, I think that physically is true, because every other state has some non-zero stress energy, which is not the same as a cosmological constant relative to the Bench-Davis vacuum state. Now, there are many reasons you might expect to start out inflation in an excited state. So, for example, you could have a sort of two-stage period of inflation, where you imagine sort of inflating up here, you solve, you have enough E-folds to solve the flatness problem, but then you have some very sudden non-adiabatic region where the slow roll approximation is violated, and you can have particle production in that region. And then you start out the second region of inflation. So this is, it's this point I'm going to call the beginning of inflation. So for me, the beginning of inflation is the earliest time at which, you know, the last period of slow roll inflation occurred. So you start out at this point. In general, you'll start out in some excited state with some particles. More generally, you can imagine all sorts of other physics, like you could have had some other field which was oscillating, and then it decays into the inflaton, and there are lots of different reasons. You could imagine starting out the inflaton in a thermal state because it becomes strongly coupled at some early time. So all those kind of things is what I have in mind. I don't really care too much about what the physics is that gives rise to that. But I'm just interested in the last sort of period of inflation up to this point. Okay. So now the crucial thing, as I've mentioned, is that back reaction is the really constraining feature that forces you to be close to the Bench-Davis vacuum state. So let's just think about the two-point function. So this is things that people have thought about a lot before. So for the stress energy for a scalar field perturbations, looks something like delta phi dot squared. So in terms of zeta, that's order epsilon zeta dot squared over M Planck squared. Oh, sorry, I'm running ahead of myself. I should actually read whatever it wrote. Okay, so before I get to that, I want to just explain, you know, just this, what, how is it that, okay, so we normally think of inflation as wiping out all initial conditions. And so for the classical background physics, this is certainly true and it works very well. So for example, let's suppose you have some matter, say monopoles there at the beginning of inflation. This is how you solve the monopole problem. The maximum energy density of those monopoles is of order h squared m Planck squared at the beginning of inflation. That's the maximum you could have had by assumption that inflation is occurring. But of course, monopoles scale like 1 over a cubed, or you could have some other radiation, massless particles that scale like 1 over a to the 4. And so by the end of inflation, this is down by, say, e to the minus 180. So it's some negligible contribution. So inflation wipes out that classical background information we can never expect to know from the background what else was kicking around at the beginning of inflation. But for perturbations, for quantum perturbations, the situation is somewhat different. Or specifically for perturbations of the inflaton, and that's crucial. Now, so one thing we all know is that the behavior of zeta, the fluctuations of the inflaton, at sub-horizon scales, okay, scales like something like this. Okay, so crucially, it scales like 1 over the scale factor. This is true exactly whenever the equation of state is constant. If you have some running as well, then this changes. But roughly speaking, that's true. That's good enough for the argument. And so that means that as your space expands and inflates, the fluctuations get smaller and smaller. So that's very similar to what's happening in the background. As your space expands, the energy density gets smaller. But what's different with the fluctuations is that as soon as the modes cross the horizon, zeta becomes constant, it's conserved. So there is a big difference here that if the mode, there's a cutoff to the extent to which a given mode gets smaller, which is of order e to the, so that given initial fluctuation, zeta star, the final fluctuation is only suppressed by the number of e folds before that mode crosses the horizon. Okay? So that, and that might not be such a large thing. So for example, if scales of the current horizon today went out of the horizon, say 55 e folds before the beginning of inflation, before the end of inflation. So if inflation wasn't too much longer than the 55 e-folds, so we have very conservative value like 60, 65 e-folds, then this number for those modes is actually only order 5 or 10. So the actual suppression of the fluctuations is much less significant than it is for the classical background information. And that's a crucial point that gives you some hope of seeing the initial quantum state in the final late time fluctuations, in other words, in the CMB. Okay. So. It's momentum dependent. What I'm going to give is very crude estimates. So I'm just going to imagine if I excite one particular mode of some momentum, then the number of e folds of expansion that mode will have before it crosses the horizon will the suppression factor will go like h over m star, where m star is the physical momentum at the beginning of inflation.
Oh, sure. I guess what I'm this would tell you by this argument that it gives you power strength of the suppression as a function of k.
That's right.
So then, would that be like different from other effects you might have?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, well, the initial state could be excited with some arbitrary k dependence, and so that's what you're going to see at late times.
So I think it's also the reason why you might hope to see this in the tensors, right? Because it would affect large scales. It would have a larger effect on large scales.
That's right. Absolutely, yeah. The suppression is more and more for smaller scales because those scales will have more e folds before they cross the horizon. So the most your best chance is at large scales. Okay. What I haven't told you is how large the initial perturbation that I give to zeta is. And that's what's constrained by back reaction. And so saying what that is important to know how much I expect to see by the time of horizon crossing when the mode gets frozen in. And that argument you just take, I think I wrote it off, but you take the stress energy of the inflaton, which I'm going to write in terms of zeta. So I think it was something like this. Okay, so let's suppose that the mode I'm going to excite has some characteristic scale at the beginning of inflation, m star. Okay, so just on dimensional grounds, that's of order m star squared, zeta star. This has to be less than h squared m Planck squared. Okay. So the maximum amount zeta star could be is bounded by h and Planck squared divided by m star squared. Something went wrong. Oh, no, that's right. Okay. So I should check what I wrote down there. Okay. I started with the wrong answer. So zeta is h delta phi over root epsilon m Planck. So this answer should have had m Planck squared at the top. Okay, that's better. Dimensions are correct. Good. So the m Planck squared cancels. Okay, so the maximum initial perturbation I can give to zeta to excite is of order h over root epsilon times m star, the momentum of that particular perturbation. And by the argument we just gave, this thing then, it scales like 1 over a, so it gets smaller and smaller, and then you evaluate it at horizon crossing, so it's going to be smaller by a factor of h over m star times this value, h over root epsilon m star. So it's like h squared over root epsilon m star squared. Now, the thing to compare with is the normal magnitude of fluctuations you generate at horizon crossing. So that's just the square root of the power spectrum. So the normal answer goes like h over square root epsilon m Planck. So if you look at the ratio of these two things, that's going to give you the typical correction to the two-point function you would expect to see. So that goes like h, the root epsilons cancel. You get h m Planck over m squared, m star squared. Okay, and this is something that if m star, okay, another way to write that is, so m star is the physical scale of the CMB at the beginning of inflation, but we can also write that as h times the number of e-folds the CMB modes go through before they cross the horizon. And so this goes like m Planck over h e to the minus n star squared. And this first number is a large number of order 10 to the 6. But of course, we're squaring it, 2 n star. Okay, but we see that, so here's where the crucial physics comes in. So if the number of e-folds before the CMB modes cross the horizon is very short, then this factor may not be very small, and you can expect to see some observable effects in the two-point function. But of course, if inflation is very long, so as soon as it becomes, say, of order 70, then when you get into the trans-Planckian region, then m star is order m Planck, and this thing goes like 10 to the minus 6, which would be too small to expect to observe. All right, so how does the argument go? Let's think about the three-point function. We can make a very similar argument. So one thing is that, I mean, this is an old result, and it's normally stated in a slightly different way in terms of the Golubov coefficients. So it's the statement that the correction to the power spectrum is order the Golubov coefficient, but the Golubov coefficients are bounded by the condition. This is the energy density of your excited state at the beginning of inflation. That has to be less than h squared m Planck squared. But the point about this dimensional argument is, even if you start with a mixed state, a thermal state, something that's not a coherent state, something that's not described in terms of the Golubov language, the same dimensional argument will be true. That's how large a correction you'd expect to see. So now let's think about the three-point function. And this is very easy to do now. So let me take that estimate of the magnitude of the fluctuation that I got from the two-point function. And we'll see that this is not quite right, but let's start with that estimate. So given that initial, let me just reiterate, the magnitude of the fluctuation of this excited state at the horizon is equal to that of its initial fluctuation times h over m star, and then that has to be less than h squared over root epsilon m star squared. So when you look at the three-point function, let's just encode it in FNL, which is roughly speaking the average of zeta cubed over the average of zeta squared squared, working in real space. What we should compare here is, so if we take the Bunch-Davis vacuum, the thing on the top is very small. So the thing to compare is the three-point function that you would expect to get from some initial excited state to the actual the normal two-point function squared. So this is of order. Okay, and this of course is evaluated. Both these things should be evaluated at the horizon. So I should take this thing cubed, which is h to the 6 over epsilon to the 3 over 2, m star to the 6, and then divided by the normal power spectrum squared. So that goes like h to the 4 over epsilon squared m Planck squared. Okay, and so that correction is, so that's h squared, so that's 4, m Planck to the 4 divided by m star to the 6, and then you get like a square root epsilon left over there. So again, this is something that's, the more e-folds you have is going to get smaller and smaller, but if the number of e-folds is not too large, it could conceivably be quite big. And so how many e-folds would that have to be to make this, say, of order 1 and therefore unobservable? So let's just stick some numbers in. So h, we can rewrite that. So again, using the fact that m star is h times e to the number of e-folds before the CMB modes cross the horizon, this contribution to FNL goes like root epsilon. So it's 6 on the bottom. So it's e to the 6 n star, h to the 6, so it's m Planck to the 4 over h to the 4. So that goes like, say, 10 to the minus 1. M Planck over h is order sort of 10 to the 6, so it's 10 to the 24 times e to the minus 6 n star. And so you can rewrite that. That is of order e to the 53 minus 6 n star. And so in particular, if the number of e-folds that the modes have before horizon crossing is greater than 8.8, then this is less than 1. But if it's less than that, so 8.8 is going to say, it's the same as saying that inflation lasts 55 points, well, plus 9, so it's sort of 64. So inflation only lasts 64 e-folds, then you could conceivably have a leftover contribution to FNL, which is greater than 1, and therefore observable.
Scale inflation and all your
I'm just to put numbers in.
Yeah, but does it help you if it's a lower reheat temperature? Or
I'm sure it does, but I haven't thought about it.
What is he from FNL?
Because you make
if your H might make H smaller.
H smaller. The smaller H is the effect is always bigger, right? Because you're farther away from the Planck scale, so. Mm-hmm. It's always when you hit the Planck scale is when you get stuck. So, but the lower you are relative to the Planck scale, then the larger effect you expect is to. Yeah. So, I'm just putting in numbers just for the classic case just to get an estimate. But this estimate is not quite correct, and that's because what I took was the magnitude. Of say you'd expect, bounded by the two-point contribution to the stress energy. But what I should really do, is bounded by the three-point contribution. So in general, the stress energy, that's the energy density for the inflaton, goes like epsilon m Planck squared zeta dot squared. But it also has some zeta cubed terms. In fact, those are precisely the terms that you use when you calculate non-Gaussianity. And so to know what this is just, if we work in the interacting picture, then we're just adding the interacting Hamiltonian in here. And so we just go to Malvicena's calculation. and find out what that is. What is the interacting Hamiltonian? And so in some choice of variables, he managed to reduce it to one term, which looked like epsilon. Okay, so it's phi dot to the 4 over h to the 4 m Planck squared h zeta dot squared 1 over spatial derivative squared zeta dot. So this thing is goes like, that's like saying epsilon squared m Planck squared h. And so we're just counting dimensions here. So you've got three derivatives divided by two derivatives. So you've really only got one derivative. That's m star, and then times zeta cubed. Okay. So if your initial state has some non-zero three-point function, it's actually this term that's going to bound the magnitude of that. It's that contribution to the stress energy. So it's this quantity that has to be less than h squared and Planck squared.
What excitus thing?
These are interactions.
But everything so far was about excitus thing.
Yeah, but the two go hand in hand, because if I take a state which is excited, so it has some non-zero three-point function, then it means that the VEV of the stress energy, which includes higher order terms from interactions, this has a non-zero vacuum expectation value.
Sure.
Okay, so the condition is not only that this term has to be less than the energy density of the inputon, but also this term. In fact, it's really this term that counts, because that's the term you're taking. That's the term you're exciting. It's the three-point function. And so surprisingly, when you work this out, so this is zeta star, the maximum fluctuation you can give at the beginning of inflation. This turns out to be, Okay, it turns out to be epsilon to the minus 2/3 h over m star to the 3rd. And that's a much bigger quantity than the previous estimate. Okay, so that's because the three-point function is small. Okay, so the actual bound, the back reaction bound coming from the three-point function is less severe than that coming from the two-point contribution. And so plugging this particular value into FNL, doing the same thing as we did before, gives you something that actually goes like m Planck over m star to the 4 with no additional suppression. So this is quite remarkable, because it's saying that as long as inflation is short enough that the physical energy scales of CMB are less than the Planck scale, then you could conceivably get some large greater than one contribution to the non-Gaussianity. That's the thing. You can actually have them independent, because this thing, the VEV of that, if I can create you a state in which I only excite the three-point function but not the two-point function. So it's a little tuned, right? But I can have a state in which the VEV of that is zero on top of the normal contribution, but the VEV of that is non-zero.
Isn't that positive definite? How could that be zero?
I'm not saying zero. Zero relative to the normal contribution when you take out, right?
I don't see how. That's positive definite, but I guess you're saying there is another.
So the normal vacuum, what I'm saying, let's think about it in terms of creation annihilation operators. So in the normal vacuum, the VEV of A dagger A is zero, right? Okay. So, but the previous argument about exciting the two-point function was in, what I was saying was that we take this to be non-zero. And in the three-point function, what I'm saying is we take combinations of three A to be non-zero. And I can take, you know, it's tuned, but I can take a state in which I excite this, but not that.
I just don't see how a positive definite is step could be zero.
It's not zero. It's zero after when you subtract a bunch of various contributions.
Okay.
So that FNL is evaluated as equilateral, or you
No, this is a dimensional argument. So the shape dependence could be anything. It depends what you put in. This is simply a dimensional argument on the magnitude of the answer you would get.
Yeah, because it's not easy to satisfy both two-point and three-point at the same time. For example, Contaldi-Linda has some initial condition, short inflation, to explain a suppression of a quadruple suppression, right? So they actually chose a very special vacuum state. So
I'm freely admitting this is a tuned vacuum state. I'm simply asking what in principle you could do.
Yeah. So if you tune that state, you also change the 2-point the 2-point equation of motion, which.
Right, so that's the state, but I can construct you a state in which I excite, I have a non-zero frequency tension, but I don't excite it.
Right, so although you have, for example, you have a strong coupling, but the zeta, the solutions for two-point function, which you plug in the zeta also is, so you cannot just just estimate that coefficient. You have to estimate a two-point function as well. So if you use that solution and choose a very special Contaldi et al. Solution, and actually reduce it numerically, generically, you don't have large number of things, unless you probably go to the folded triangle limit, which is a non-bounded space.
Right. Yeah, no, I'm really asking in the most general terms for any space. Possibly imagine how large an effect you could have. So
yeah, but it's more sensible to keep the 2-point viable and then generate 3-point.
Right, so the first argument was one consistent with the 2-point function saying.
Yeah, but it's not easy to say 2-point. We'll talk about later, yeah.
Sure. Okay, so I'll let you go.
Questions? Oh, very short. I guess it's just too late.